This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Evelyn Araluen is a poet, researcher and co-editor of Overland Literary Journal. Her widely published criticism, fiction and poetry have been awarded the Nakata Brophy Prize for Young Indigenous Writers, the Judith Wright Poetry Prize, a Wheeler Centre Next Chapter Fellowship and a Neilma Sydney Literary Travel Fund grant. Born and raised on Darug country, she is a descendant of the Bundjalung Nation. Evelyn's debut is Drop Bear, published now by UQP. Evelyn Araluen, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Evelyn, I'm going to start where we always start. Have you always been a storyteller from when you were a little kid?
So I've always been, I think, really well surrounded by stories and storytelling from a cultural context, you know, being an Aboriginal person, it is really important to constantly teach and learn through storytelling. But I was also very lucky to have parents who were really engaged with writing and reading and were really actively just trying to make sure that we always had books in the house, always had something to read. They were always reading actively to us, which is, I think, really incredible given that six kids is a lot, and to read to all of them is a pretty intense thing.
Where do you come in the six?
So it's my brother, and then there's five girls, and I'm the second of the five girls. So I actually have to share being a middle child my younger sister, which explains 95% of my personality.
Did you then inherit and pass on the reading? So did big kids read to little kids or?
Yeah. And the funny thing is, now that you mention it, you know, I think about my younger siblings, they really loved me making up stories for them. So we had this endless ongoing saga about the unicorn fairy princess mermaid that just endlessly allowed my youngest sister to self-insert her own fantasies of being a princess and a fairy and a unicorn and a mermaid. So that went on for years and years and years, actually.
But don't you learn so much about what a reader wants when you're making up those stories?
Oh, tremendously. They just want more and more. And they want you to keep talking so that they don't have to go to sleep, which is very strategic. So I'm really glad that I actually learned some restraint and some editorial discretion around not excessively repeating or adding to text, because the odds were stacked against me by virtue of being on story time duty for the little ones.
Truly stacked against you. Evelyn, there was this really interesting thread you posted yesterday on Twitter, and you began with this first time you ever did anything, and you called it in the slightly literary scene, and what your dad asked you to then go and do. Can you just tell us about that and what it meant for you?
Yeah, so I started writing in a slightly serious way after I was learning my great-grandfather's language in TAFE, and it's then kind of began a much more active involvement, particularly with Aboriginal literary spaces. So pretty early on, I started trying to look at perhaps doing some events and creating some other opportunities for Aboriginal people, particularly around Sydney and Redfern, to perform and read some work, some poetry. So Dad, even though I grew up in Western Sydney and we weren't speaking about necessarily the same exact space, Dad really wanted me to ensure that people back home were conscious of what I was doing, that it was all just made, you know, it was all made clear and transparent, not necessarily even just for accountability purposes, but also because I think sometimes, and particularly those of us who might be a little bit shy, and it's hard to describe myself as a shy person because I'm enormously extroverted, but I am very, you know, weird about putting myself out there sometimes. So I thought it would just be really obnoxious and they wouldn't want to hear a bar of it. And I was quite surprised. You know, he brought me along to Elders Morning Tea to kind of talk to community and talk to representatives and leaders about just what I wanted to do and if they had any suggestions. But, yeah, it really just came down to being open, transparent and communicative around my processes and giving them the capacity to check up on me and even to be proud of what I was doing if, you know, they wanted to be proud. So it set up a very good precedent, I think, for thinking about, like, how responsibility can be a generative force behind a creative practice as opposed to a restrictive one.
I love that. It's really interesting. Let's talk about Drop Bear. Declan Fry for The Guardian, among all the lovely things that he said, also wrote, "One word suffices to describe my impression as I read this, oof." And I think that that is utterly a word that I would use to describe it. I have read it twice already, but I think it needs even more readings to fully understand all that you've done in there, Evelyn. But also one can read it the first time and it's just beautiful to the ear. I'm going to ask you please to read for us.
All right. This is called Suburb Paratext. "Lately, I've been footnoting social space with con and paratext, corner lingering too far from home under late night on local neons. I dress in translation to arrive late at the party and sit at the back of the function on the furthest edge lounge, drinking my own others with bottom fridge piss, raising found vessel to field swung violet 16. It comes out a dollar a standard unless you've remembered that one simple trick to make your belly small, that it's like your liver is a voucher for 4 cents free, a liter that you leave on the dash for the durry run, for all that a servo is good for in this town. Lately, I've been playing battleships with the six drinks deeper, unfolding time immemorial against six generations settled, six figures earned, six continents conquered, an encounter mathematically certain for even such an East sub 20 something life lived, but a first, a second perhaps. Amidst opinion and permission, a backlit focus group surveys my influence on the revolution, inscribed on shirts I don't wear in these suburbs. Fuck suburbs without servos, and from beneath I am above all this," says this scene's comment section. "These nights are held tongue cemeteries of unread article tabs. They aren't the time or place, but they're full of the wind ones on which I waste all my learned words for this place, the ones for whom I give sandstone stories and voice edge and Twitter trials. Such nights forget that every field I ever stumbled through was stolen. Forget 16 violent in hand-me-down dreams of dresses I'd never threadbare, of belly fuller than any of my generations before. Such nights forget the choice in nights, a channel, a switch, the drive west tolled to an occupying state, a screen dark on setting, a home."
Thank you. I want to ask about some of the images, the iconography. You know, as you go through, there's like song lines, there's lines from advertising. I was really interested in the way that you collected everything, played with it, like your actual kind of storage, if it's brain storage or if you've got stuff pasted up. I know that you did this as part of your PhD. Was this work as part of your PhD or separate?
It became a part of the PhD. Sure. I did try to keep it separate, but actually now my PhD is increasingly becoming a more experimental take on theory and theory writing. So there are sections where I've attempted to basically just take like arguments and chapters from my PhD and turn it into poems and weird erasure poems and stuff as well. I started off by going back to a lot of the kids' books that my parents have kept. And so some of the poems like Mrs. Snugglepot, Mrs. Kookaburra, Advisors and Natives or something like that. I don't know what my own poems are called. There's a poem in there that's just almost like a found poem of May Gibbs stories. There's poems that react and respond to individual like films or projects. And it was just a really long and extensive process of going back and either revisiting things or watching things for the first time, reading things for the first time that otherwise I would not have touched with a 10-foot pole. But yeah, it was kind of like an archival history that I was very lucky to be able to access because my dad just is a hoarder of books. So I did a lot of that, like I processed a lot of that research with the Wheeler Center's Next Chapter Fellowship, and then it kind of all just got regurgitated out into poems and essays, some of them which didn't make it into the collection because they were just too insane. But, you know, there might be space for that later on if I feel like I've got more, if I've got more low-hanging fruit to go after at some point in my career.
Excellent. It's always good to have the low-hanging fruit just waiting there for you. I have to say I first became obsessed with your writing when I read your piece that won the Nakata Brophy Prize in 2017, Mayam?
Mayam, A Transgression. Yeah,
A Transgression. Yeah. And I remember at the time just being completely and utterly gobsmacked by it and by what you did with language specifically and the way that you play with it and the different forms and combined words and tenses and images. Alison Whittaker says of your verse in Drop Bear, she says, it has an unrivaled and merciless clarity of expression. How do you do that, Evelyn? Like what is your process? What are your influences? How did you develop this particular style, which is so incredible to read, and you know, it makes you go back over the each line again and go, hang on, what did she just do with that? I love it. Please tell us how you did.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. Painstakingly slowly, but only after I started studying language. So I've been writing for a really long time in my own particular ways, and I can go back and look at short stories and things that I would have published in like student journals and stuff at uni and that kind of thing. And I never wrote poetry. I was only a prose writer at the time. And there was a much more kind of purple prose style and a kind of a respect for the English language there. And when I was like 22 or 23 or something like that, I started studying Bunjilang through TAFE, and something kind of dislodged itself in my brain around nouns and verbs and grammatical structures. And as a result, I lost a lot of respect I had in the restrictions that we do place on language. There is like a fairly observable phenomenon from a lot of Aboriginal writers regarding this kind of verbification of nouns and retaining the imagery and the associations of certain words, but making them, you know, active and agential. And that relates to different concepts and cultural ideas about agency and the living and, you know, non-human living spirit and such. But yeah, going and like learning about my ancestral language and learning about the different ways in which words related to each other started to increasingly unpick my own style in writing. And then it ended up with texts like Mayam, which are very much doing everything you're not supposed to do in a conventional English prose context. And I've never really worked with an editor on prose, and I feel terrible about anyone that whoever does have to do that one day. But, yeah, it's a very, very slow process of working out what could result out of a different configuration, particularly if I retain images as much as I possibly can, which is what I try to do in all my writing.
That is so interesting. I would listen to an entire lecture series on you just talking about that in particular, Evelyn. I want to ask about editing because I know that you had Ellen Van Nieuwen work on Drop Bear with you, and they are such an incredible poet. And I was kind of trying to work out, oh my gosh, you two collaborating, that's just also a conversation I would like to hear. What was that process like?
Ellen is exceptional, and I really feel like I owe like a lot of the kind of force behind my own writing to Ellen. I was shortlisted with them in the Nakata Brophy a couple of years ago. That was like my first publication, and they reached out to me and were like, hey, this is so exciting. Congratulations. And like ostensibly we were like competitors, but Ellen was just from the get-go there with like generosity and enthusiasm. And so I was like insanely grateful for that. And when the opportunity arose to work with Ellen, I was just like, yep, okay, all right, sign me up, whatever, whatever it takes. And they just have such a close eye and such a questioning gaze. And it's a technique that I've like spent a lot of time trying to think about because I admire it so much. But Ellen will draw your attention to things, issues and potential pitfalls of a text, and will kind of set you up to arrive at the conclusion for what you need to do to fix that without pushing you there themselves, which I respect tremendously. And I think that has to take like such a fierce intellect and such a strong trust in the person you're working with. Like you have to trust that they'll be able to pick up what you're communicating and will do that work themselves and know that it will be better if they arrive at that themselves. So Ellen wasn't necessarily giving me insanely detailed line edits. It was like a comment here that dislodged my own kind of version of what that piece needed to be and pushed me into a better and stronger direction for all of that work. So yeah, just incredibly grateful. There are like I can point to a handful of my now favorite poems in the collection that Ellen made like pushed me to write because they knew what was missing and what I was not willing to talk about at that stage, but that I had to get the collection to its final point.
That sounds like an extraordinary editorial relationship. You in an interview you did for the ABC, you used this beautiful phrase, extra scaffolding and the debris left over, when you were describing how you have the kind of echo of previous versions of a poem in your head when you're editing. And I wanted to ask, kind of extend that question about how you know when the poem is finished, when you have dislodged that final thing or got to the deep core of the poem, or are they ever finished?
I kind of always hold like two minds about something where I simultaneously like want to respect the feelings and the experiences that I brought to like a piece that got me to write a piece in a certain way at the time. And I never want to delete that or to erase that version of something because it'll often reveal something else more significant. You know, so for example, like, you know, there's a poem very early in the collection, Learning Bunjalung of Darawal, which was ostensibly about one very specific kind of experience. And there was what I would now kind of call like a debris there of another poem, Guarded by Birds, which is about a very, very different topic, but it had those pieces there. And that was another story that wanted to be told and another piece that wanted to be explored. And if I deleted that stuff, if I'd been ruthless at the start and only focused on, you know, what was reinforcing the sort of the most central voice of the poem, I would have lost that other piece. So I have a lot of respect for like retaining earlier parts of your process. But in terms of like a collection and when, you know, you have to freeze frame a poem, you can no longer keep four or five different versions for whatever kind of context you might want to read it in or place it in. And that's difficult and challenging. And there's maybe a handful of poems in there that I'm like, you know, maybe that was not the very best version of what that poem could be, but it operated within the context of the collection. And I was happy with, I was happy with doing that for this freeze frame. So everything that's in here is done. It's fixed. It's over. And I'm not going to stress about going back to view any of that. But going forward with my own writing, like, yeah, I won't trust a poem until I've rewritten it like two or three times. It can't possibly be redone until I've done that, I think, and until other eyes have looked on it, other hands have touched it. That's just got to be where it goes from there. I don't trust this idea of like raw talent or raw inspiration. I think it's something that we all aspire to that is just too often it's just too often an illusion that shies us away from doing the real work.
Mm. great phrase framing. I think that's really a useful way to look at it. In your extraordinary poem, Breath, the narrator asks, what use is witness at the end of worlds? And I wanted to ask you, Evelyn, at a time when, you know, writers and artists of all kinds may kind of feel hopeless in the face of creating art when the world is as it is, how do you find motivation to keep writing and keep putting words down and creating?
Yeah, I think it really is. It's an important question to be asking how much we think we could do. And there are, you know, there's long histories of really wonderful writers and thinkers asking the important questions that kind of just break down all of our preconceptions about our own capacity. So like one that I return to a lot is from Eve Tuck, who's a First Nations scholar from Turtle Island, and she asks, do we need research or do we need organising? And that's in an academic context, but I similarly think that in writing and literature we should be asking, you know, do we need to write or do we need to organise? And I think that we absolutely need to do both, and one does not necessarily exclude the other. So I think it's important to keep writing. It's important to keep storytelling. It's important to keep doing things that remind and reaffirm what it is to actually be human. But that creative production, like I just don't trust escapism anymore. I don't think it's responsible. I think we need to look at the world that we're in as clearly and consciously as we possibly can, with as much ugliness and honesty and chaos as is actually in the world. So to keep writing, to document, to record, maybe, you know, at some point somebody will learn from it, but maybe they won't. But it was at least a relic of something. So it might not be the most pragmatic thing that I could be doing with every single hour of my life. But I believe in the importance of continuing to talk and reflect honestly about who we are, or else, I mean, I don't really know what the point of anything else is in that case.
The other kind of thing that you do that is deeply pragmatic and in that organising capacity is your role of co-editor at Overland. And you did this great interview with Astrid Edwards on The Garret where you talk really specifically about that role. And about this kind of laborious, shitty task, really, the administrative task of looking for grants and funding, but how you think that's really important to be done by someone who is a writer. Can you just expand on that a little bit for this audience?
Yeah, so I think that we're in a really difficult and frustrating space in the arts and the humanities more broadly in Australia, where funding is so scarce and under so much scrutiny for the kinds of projects that should be shared amongst our community. And I don't trust everyone making those decisions. I don't think that would be any surprise to anyone. So there is this like very fierce competitiveness around that kind of work. And I was surprised when I began working for Overland how much of my experience was simply trying to endlessly fund and justify the projects that we produce, projects that have a history of being proven to be valuable. But I have learned in my experience with this project that if these projects, that if it's not artists and writers and the people most directly affected by the financial and cultural implications of that work, it will be further distanced from the realities of that kind of process and the realities of what artists need and what helps sustain the community more broadly and how that can be most ethically and effectively shared throughout the broader community. So the solution, I think, really does have to be an increase in funding and a more flexible and adaptive structure of explaining work and justifying the necessity and importance of that work, which just takes a kind of good faith from government that we have not seen. We have not seen legislated or organised around for a very long time. unfortunately, not really in my lifetime. So, you know, and maybe that's something that, you know, we return to this question of like, do we need organizing at this time? I think we do. And I think artists and writers should also be activists in that kind of space because, yeah, as I said, if we give up that power or capacity with this logic or assumption that will that it will enhance or reinforce our own time for creative practice, we'll actually lose the power to direct those processes ourselves.
How do you, you know, with your work with Overland, your academic work, your own writing, how do you arrange your week and life in general so that you get the work done? Like, have you come to a place where you're like, yes, this is a way that it is working, or are you still aspiring to that?
I'm still aspiring to that. It's a very strange balance, and I have discovered that I unfortunately just have a bad personality type for the kinds of ways in which I've had to sort of structure my life, and those three sort of quite disparate directions of work. So working from home over the last 12 months has been pretty hellish, particularly when, you know, I've moved into state once, I've moved house twice in that time. And I've got a very needy rescue dog who constantly demands any and all attention I can give her. So yeah, I keep on delusioning myself with this idea that, you know, taking social media breaks is going to change everything, or that, you know, if I have a clean desk, I'll be effective. but if there is a structure of productivity in which I am a useful human being and a useful contributor to the economy, I haven't yet worked it out, unfortunately. I have not been able to structure my day in anything like a responsible or healthy practice, probably since I was about like 16 and doing my HSC, and my parents didn't let me fuck that up.
Have you been able to get reading back in? I read on your shelf reflection for KYD that you are still in recovery from what your PhD did to your reading practice. Are you reading again for pleasure?
I'm trying to a lot more now, and I'm still struggling with not constantly feeling a need to analyze. And the other thing I struggle with is creating lists of things to read, as opposed to actually reading those books. So that's
just publish your lists for us. That would be useful.
I'm so happy to do that, and you'll all be embarrassed and ashamed of the stuff that I should have read by now, but that I really haven't read.
We all have. Yeah. Lists.
Oh, it's the constant fantasy. We love endlessly stocking a bookshelf of hopes and dreams and aspirations that we then inevitably feel really bad about. But yeah, I'm actually going to, I think it's gotten to the point where I really do just need to force myself like an hour or two of reading a day and regiment it, because as soon as I get back into the energy and space of that, I love it. I'm so happy. And it's just forcing myself to do that. But if it's any consolation, I also haven't really watched any TV for an incredibly long time, because when studying my PhD, I told myself, no, if you watch TV, that means you're not researching and you should do that. So I've just been watching TikTok for like a year, basically, and it's really bad for my brain. So I should delete the app. That's the first thing I should do to get back into reading properly.
So many of us should delete so many apps. We always ask our guests if you have advice for a new writer, someone trying to get published, someone who might be hoping to follow in your footsteps, what would be the advice that you would give a younger you, Evelyn?
Well, listen, now I feel like I've set myself up, because my advice actually should just be to read, to read as actively as you possibly can. You know, in the process of writing Drop Bear, I would say that I probably read about 60 different poetry collections, Australian poetry collections, to kind of get my energy in that direction. And I really think it made a profound difference, a profound impact on my work. But really my biggest advice is that you just can't do it. You can't do it in a solo space. Writing as a isolated act is no longer, or if, even if it ever was, but that's not a healthy way of thinking about it. And it's not realistic. Go to literary events, go to launches, involve yourself in conversations, submit regularly without expecting that you will always be accepted, but with an understanding that you will be able to engage with conversations with those editors, a lot of whom, you know, I've spoken to, you know, like Toby Fitch, for example, who reads, the poor fellow just has to read hundreds and hundreds of poems every month from what we get in. And I'm so struck, you know, by his patience and the care he has around that, because he's always, you know, is loving to see how people's work is developing. And even if something's not right for Overland, like he's still, you know, is so willing to have like a positive thing to say about where work is developing. So just don't be afraid to submit with this idea that you can only ever enter your greatest, best pieces for consideration. It doesn't work like that. You can't always predict what people are going to like or what they're going to take an interest with. So really it's just be open to community, be open to critique, be open to learning from other writers, and embrace as much of that as you possibly can.
Excellent advice. And do you have for us a debut recommendation of a book, anytime, any place?
Yes. So Adam Thompson's Born Into This is a short story collection, and that was released in February. And Adam is a really fantastic writer from Tasmania who I was doing the next chapter alongside. So I think it's a great book, as you know, well as sort of, you know, the writing itself being wonderful, but also just thinking about like how I saw Adam's voice develop over the process of putting that collection together, and Kate Kennedy as his mentor and such. So for me, I'm just like, yeah, beautiful, love it. You've got to read it. But I think a lot of other people are going to appreciate it, not just for that development, just because it's telling great stories about a space that we don't always hear much from. So check it out.
It's definitely on my list. Evelyn Araluen, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me again.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.